When I was growing up, one of my favorite things to do was go trick-or-treating on Halloween. And being from a poor neighborhood, it was our luck as we went around the neighborhood to get lots of cheap candy. And we always dreamed of hitting the jackpot where you'd go to that house where all they're giving away is full-size chocolate candy bars. And that happened one year, finally. I happened to be in Washington, D.C., as a matter of fact, going through this neighborhood of million-dollar homes. And what do you know, someone giving away nutrageous candy bars. Oh, I thought, man, full-size, king-size, nutrageous candy bars. What more could a person want, I thought. You wouldn't have found anyone that was a happier 33-year-old man. These didn't come out till 1994. But unfortunately, that's the attitude that a lot of people have. We have all these little trinkets, the material things of this world, and we think, what more could we want? And that's what we're going to talk about this evening. The series we've been focusing on is the choice that we have of putting our mind on the things of this world or putting our mind on things above where Christ is. And that we have a choice of living in this world and being of it, or living in this world but not being of it. We don't have a choice about whether we're going to be in the world or not, but whether we participate in the things of this world or not. That is the real decision that we have to make. And we want to begin with reviewing some of the basic principles that we've dealt with to the point so far in our lesson. You remember in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 22 that Paul had given this instruction to Timothy to flee youthful lusts. And the question arises, well, what are these youthful lusts? Are they lust of the body, like a lust for candy bars, or the sexual appetite, or alcohol, or chemicals? And certainly those things would be included. But I think in more broad terms of the types of sin that we are attracted to, such as the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the empty pride of life. And that what is really at the root of all lusts, and certainly including youthful lusts, are those sins of pride, those sins of self-centeredness and being preoccupied with self. And we contrasted these youthful lusts with what Paul goes on to talk about in the rest of the verse, which is pursuing righteousness and faith and love and peace. And part of how God tempers that youthful preoccupation with self is He reminds us that we are to do this with others who call upon the Lord out of a pure heart. And what we find reflected in this passage are two of the great relationships that we are called to in Jesus Christ. That we have a relationship with God, and that relationship is the foundation of our purity. And when you find the subject of purity throughout the New Testament, it is always in regard to a relationship, not isolated acts of goodness, things that we do here and there that are good things. It is a manifestation of a relationship that we have with God. And it is that devotion to God, devotion as of a friend or of a child to his parent, that causes us to be pure because we love God more than we love self, and we trust in Him and value His things more than we do self. And so these lusts, of course, undermine those relationships and corrupt those relationships. And that's why God warns us away from these things. We were created in the image of God to be in relationships. That's the ultimate essence of what it is to be human. And therefore we are to live selflessly and for other people. And so the moment we make that choice to serve self, we have denied our humanity. And we have corrupted the very image of God in which we have been made. And so these are the very things we need to flee from so that we can have the kind of relationships that God would have us to have. Now it's in 1 Timothy chapter 6 where Paul also gives Timothy this instruction and tells him something to flee from. And so I have to imagine that this is included in the youthful lust of which he speaks in the second letter. He says in verse 9, people who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, And some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. But flee from these things, you men of God, and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, perseverance, and gentleness. And so this lust for material things, this desire for money, also cuts at the very foundation of our relationship. This love for money corrupts our relationships. Why is that? Because our grasping for money is a lack of trust in God. We're not satisfied. God does not prepare for us adequately. God does not provide adequately. And so we cannot depend upon God. Who are we going to depend upon? And Jesus explored this question in the Sermon on the Mount. Do we really doubt that God will provide? Why do we think life consists of these material things and they have to be grasped for? And you think of this from the perspective of God. What kind of insult it is to God that we cannot trust Him for the most basic necessities of life that He gives to the common animals. And it is a slap in the face of God. It is a denial of the very relationship that we claim to have with God. And so the love of money corrupts that very relationship. And as part of the Sermon on the Mount, what Jesus said was that where your treasure is where your heart is. And so the fact that we're grasping for money shows that our heart is not really with God. It is not really focused upon a relationship with God. Furthermore, Jesus said, no one can be enslaved to two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot be enslaved to both God and money. And what we find here is a recurrent theme we've seen time and again already in our series of lessons. This is a mutually exclusive choice. You are either a friend of God and an enemy of this world, or you are a friend of this world and an enemy of God. And of course, that doesn't mean being an enemy of the people of this world. It means being an enemy of all of that rebellion and sin that is allied against God. We do care about the people. That's why God leaves us here in their midst, to reach out to them as lights shining in a dark place. And so we're going to be exploring this question of the problem with money tonight. And I know what a lot of you are thinking. The problem with money that I have is I don't have enough of it. But that's not really the problem that we have. The problem, biblically, you might say, is manifest by these facts, that there are twice as many verses on money than there are prayer and faith combined. That Jesus talked more about money than he did heaven and hell, and that about 15% of Jesus' teaching involves money in some form or another. And that indicates it was a problem in the time of Jesus, and it remains a problem in our own day. We may live in a more prosperous society, and indeed we may live even in a more materialistic society. But this is no new sin. The Bible speaks quite often of covetousness, of greed, of this material desire and love for things instead of God. And how much more so we ought to be reminded of this today, because just 5 years ago we witnessed billions of dollars of human wealth crumble into a pile of absolute worthlessness. And those buildings represented the great economic power, the center of the economic power of the United States. And you realize that human accomplishment avails for very little. And why would we put our trust in such fleeting material things? And yet the fact of the matter is, so many of us do. Consider these facts about the problem of money in the modern world. 83% of college students have credit cards. Probably not a bad idea if you're trying to get your credit established. But the problem is that $2,700 is the average credit card balance for freshmen. And by the time they get out of college into graduate school, it's $4,746. 20% of these people owe between $3,000 and $7,000, and another 9% owe more than $7,000. And that is just an indication of the problem that these college students are having. When you consider the world at large, the typical card-holding family, and of course not everybody does, but the typical card-holding family owes 10 different creditors about $17,000 of debt that is not mortgage-related. They're paying 18.9% average interest on their credit card. That means they're paying $83.33 just in interest every month. And the average increase in the cost of items they buy with their credit cards is 112%. That means when you're so careful to go shopping and find that great bargain and find those that pair of pants for $9, it's really going to cost you about $20. Not such a great deal anymore because you're buying it on credit. $9,205, the average cardholder debt. And 92% of people's disposable income is going to pay for debt. And that only leaves them a very little bit to spend on other things. 23% are maxed out on their credit cards. Another 25% have credit problems of one kind or another. 40% of families are living beyond their means and spending more than they're taking in each month. 60% do not pay off their balance monthly. And the ones that do are called deadbeats by the credit card companies because they're not making money off of them. And so you have an $8,000 debt at 18%. It'll take you about 25 years to pay it off at the minimum rate. And you'll wind up paying about three times as much for it. And so that represents some serious problems that people are having with money. Now, there are occasions, of course, where people need to borrow money and things can happen. People can have medical bills and so on that affect their financial situation. But clearly, the vast majority of this credit problem that so many people are having is this desire to have everything that is beyond their means. They want all the good things of this life, but don't really want to pay for it. Or they think they will defer it to the future and find themselves not able to pay for it. And it is this lust for material things that should not be something that drives Christians. Because our hearts and minds are to be focused on Christ that is above. And when you look up where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God, you don't have big screen plasma TV sets. You don't have all the fancy electronics, new computer. That's not what heaven is about. And that's not where our treasure is supposed to be. Now think about this. There are three approaches that people can take to money. First of all, there's living beyond your means, of course. And what does the Bible say about that? Well, in Proverbs chapter 22, in verse 7, this proverb says, "The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave." How true that is. That echoes one of the curses that God had pronounced back in Deuteronomy chapter 28, that the alien would prevail over the Israelite. And one of the ways in which he would prevail was they would borrow from the alien, but not the other way around. Back in Proverbs chapter 6, notice in the first few verses here, "My son, if you have become surety for your neighbor, you co-signed a loan, have given a pledge for a stranger, if you've been snared with the words of your mouth, have been caught with the words of your mouth, do this then, my son, and deliver yourself. Since you've come into the hand of your neighbor, go humble yourself and importune your neighbor. Do not give sleep to your eyes or slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand and like a bird from the hand of the fowler." Don't get entrapped in a debt that you're not able to pay. And indeed, that's the problem that many people find themselves in. It's not only the problem of slavery, being enslaved to that monthly minimum payment, being enslaved to paying for things that are already broken and thrown in the trash can, but we still have the money credited against us on our credit card statement. And it's still going to be there 20 years down the road. That's truly a form of slavery. But the real problem, of course, is that of greed. What's the Bible say about greed? Well, you remember back in Colossians chapter 3, this is one of the passages that has been something of a foundation passage for our series of studies. That if you've been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on earth. For you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, is revealed, then you also will be revealed with Him in glory. What we are to be enslaved to is Christ. He is my life. My whole identity is wrapped up in Him. He possesses me, not a credit card company. But notice, Paul goes on to say, therefore consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which is the same thing as idolatry. And that's the real root of the problem. That we have taken God and we've said, God, I don't trust You. You are inadequate. The things that I need, a sense of security and satisfaction in life, this pile of money will provide. And I'm going to put that in place of God. And I'm going to worship that. And that's what's going to preoccupy my thoughts and take up my time. And Paul says, put your mind on things above, not on the things that are on this earth. And so if we're living beyond our means, we have enslaved ourselves, and for no good reason other than we are greedy. But then there's another thing we can do. We can live beneath our means. And that also is greed. You picture somebody who's miserly and they're hoarding up what they have. They've got more than enough. They're not spending beyond their resources. But the very reason they're hoarding it up is because they're greedy. You never know, rainy day might come. And you know this kind of character from back in Luke chapter 12, of course, the rich fool. And you remember the context of this story. In verse 13 of Luke chapter 12, someone in the crowd yells out and says, make my brother divide the inheritance with me. And Jesus doesn't really address whether this man's in the right or in the wrong. I guess we should assume that he's in the right. His brother should divide the inheritance with him. But think about this. His relationship with his brother is not nearly as important to him as getting his share of the money. And I think that's the attitude that Jesus is addressing here. And you see that corruption of relationships that is brought upon us by the love of money. And so Jesus says in verse 15, beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. That's not what life is about, Jesus says. And he goes on to give the illustration of the rich fool, that he has all of this productivity and where's he going to put it? He needs bigger barns. He's going to tear down and build them. And he takes no thought for tomorrow. He makes no provision for his spiritual future. And so his life is required of him. And he is seen to be a fool because he lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. And so if we're hoarding what we have because we're greedy, that's not a good way to live either. Well, I know what you're thinking. That only leaves one other thing. That's living at your means. But that too is self-indulgent. You might remember Jesus warned about the Pharisees who were filled with greed and uncleanness and all manner of self-indulgence. And we read about the rich in James chapter 5, a description here that can very well encompass different aspects that we've talked about. He says, beginning in verse 1 of James chapter 5, come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, your garments have become moth-eaten, your gold and silver have rusted. Their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure, and you have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. And so here's a person who's just indulging themselves, spending every penny they got on themselves. And that's not how the Lord wants us to live either. Well, if we're not to live beyond our means or beneath our means or at our means, what are we supposed to do? What is the Christian's approach to money? Well, we need to realize that there's no such thing as your means. The way we ought to speak is of God's means. And that means, of course, that we're talking about stewardship. Being stewards of what belongs to somebody else. Being entrusted with money for a short while that we will have to leave behind for someone else to take care of when we're gone. And I'm afraid sometimes we leave a wrong impression. We take up a collection on the Lord's Day and we'll say, well, now's the time to give back to the Lord. Well, that's true. But unfortunately, a lot of people leave with the impression that's the only time you give back to the Lord. The fact of the matter is, every penny I have belongs to the Lord. And every time I use it the way God wants me to use it, I glorify Him and I'm giving it back to the Lord. Jesus makes that point in Mark chapter 7 when He talks about this principle of Korban that the Jews had come up with. I can take my money and donate it to the temple, and isn't that a holy work? Isn't the temple more important than you, mom and dad, your own personal individual comforts? I'm doing a great work over here, holy work. And now I don't have the money to feed you this month. And you're just going to have to suffer. Isn't it worth it, mom and dad? Don't you think the Lord is worth it? And Jesus says, you deny the very word of God. To honor father and mother means to take care of them in their old age, to provide for them. And when a person does that, are they honoring God? And are they giving their money back to the Lord? Of course they are. The only question is, are we truly spending our money on the things that glorify God? Are we truly recognizing that all of it belongs to God and we're merely stewards of it? Now, from time to time, you might hear brethren complain, you know, someone said, well, we need to take up a special collection for something. And somebody will say, well, you know, really shouldn't have to preach on people giving a little bit more because they already ought to be giving till it hurts, and they ought to be giving every penny they can. And so if the preacher can get up and motivate them to give more, it shows they've been holding out on the Lord. Well, that's not the point. The point is, if I'm looking at my resources that I have and I'm giving them all to the Lord, and part of that is giving to a local congregation because I'm a part of that congregation and I believe what it stands for and I've committed myself to helping its work, and if it has some financial needs, I need to be doing my share of supporting that. But that's just one part of my life as a Christian. I may also be helping my brother who's over in Romania. I might also be helping take care of my mom and dad in Arkansas. And as you look at these different needs and how you're parceling out your resources, it may very well be that somebody comes up and say, well, we've got a real need here. Somebody's starving to death. And I'll say, well, I'll call my brother up and tell him not to expect that extra money this month. And I'll reallocate my resources. Not because we're holding out on the Lord. It's simply because we continually reevaluate what the need is and where we can best use our money to serve the Lord in all of the different ways that we do. And so we shouldn't equate the money that we give to a church with money that we give to the Lord. It's all the Lord's money, and we're just stewards of it. And certainly when we give of our means, when we give up our monies for things that glorify God, there ought to be an awareness of that and an acknowledgement of that, because it reinforces to us that these are not for self-indulgent purposes. They are truly for the purpose of God. And that's what we mean when we talk about stewardship. And I want to talk to you in the time that we have left about some different aspects of stewardship. Because even along this line, people develop some rather peculiar ideas sometimes. It seems to me that most of the strange ideas that brethren come up with have to do with money. There's just something about money that makes us not think clearly. What is it about stewardship? Well, first of all, we need to understand this biblical principle of contentment and acceptance of what God provides for us and has given to us. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, Paul has a great deal to say about wealth in this chapter, and in particular in directing Timothy to teach people who are wealthy. And one of the first things we notice is that there can be wealthy Christians. And Paul doesn't say, now Timothy, you point out to these wealthy Christians that they shouldn't be wealthy. How dare they accumulate some money? They must be doing something wrong. And they need to go get rid of all of this money. But that's not what Paul says. Now certainly that was the instruction that Jesus gave to the rich young ruler. And it became obvious because of his response to that command of God. He couldn't do it. And Jesus knew he wouldn't be able to do it. That was his test, and he failed. But there have been many people in the Bible, both in the Old Testament and the New, who were wealthy people. And they were able to be wealthy and to use their wealth to glorify God. And that's what Paul is talking about here. But notice in verse 6, having referred to these false brethren who believe that godliness is a means of gain, it leads him to make this observation, but godliness really is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For we brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. And if we have food and covering, with these we shall be content." And that's what leads him into that passage that we read at the beginning of the lesson. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. They're not content. They don't trust God. They're not satisfied with what God has provided. And so if we're going to be good stewards of what God has provided for us, and if we're going to necessarily have to deal with these worldly things, there is a sense in which our eyes have to look at what's going on in this world. We still are embodied people. We still have to eat. We still have to sleep. We still have to use money. And so when Paul says to set our mind on things above where Christ is, that doesn't mean we no longer take note of the things that go on in this life. But rather that we use the things in this life for the purpose that we look above. And so we eat for Christ. We sleep for Christ. We use our money for Christ. And that is expressed with this attitude of contentment and acceptance of what God has provided for us. Secondly, there is this principle of enjoyment. Now, this is one of those things that people might scratch their head and say, well, surely the Bible wouldn't say people should enjoy their wealth. But notice what is said a little bit later in verse 17. "Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed." And so you notice in verse 17, God richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. We ought to take enjoyment out of the things that God has given to us. And we do that by having this thankful attitude that comes out of our contentment. And I dare say a great deal of the enjoyment that one has of the things that God has provided is not merely in some kind of self-indulgent way, but by using these things for the benefit and help of others, by sharing and doing good works with others. Now, that doesn't mean you necessarily consume up all of your wealth, because then you'd have no wealthy people to give this instruction to. But God gives us these things to enjoy. And He says earlier in the fourth chapter that we're to receive the food that God has given to us with thanksgiving, because God has created it indeed to be enjoyed. Thirdly, the principle of stewardship also implies some restraint and using wisdom in restraining ourselves. If we go back to the book of Proverbs, for example, again in the sixth chapter, right after the section where we read about co-signing a loan and getting out of it, beginning in verse 6, "Go to the ant, O sluggard. Observe her ways and be wise, which, having no chief, officer, or ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provision in the harvest. How long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. And your poverty will come in like a vagabond and your need like an armed man." Proper stewardship means we have to exercise some restraint. We need to, on the one hand, apply ourselves in work. And on the other hand, we need to restrain ourselves in just wasteful spending and whittling it away down to nothing and misusing it. Jesus used this principle by way of illustration in Matthew chapter 25 when He talked about the different servants that had been entrusted with the master's money. He says down in verse 26 that wicked, lazy slave should have taken the money and invested it in the bank. Should have done something with it. Should have exercised some wisdom. Applied himself. But in this case, he did nothing because he was fearful of his master. But the other side of this is we also need to be generous and be wise in our generosity. You remember what the Apostle Paul said in Ephesians chapter 4. Here in a series of exhortations that are both negative and then positive, he says in verse 28 that the one that steals should steal no longer, but rather let him labor, performing with his own hands what is good, in order that he may have something to share with him who has need. There are people that are in need. And there are people who are capable of having the wherewithal to help those people. We ought to do that. We ought to have that kind of liberality, that kind of generosity. In 1 John chapter 3, in verse 16, John said, "We know love by this, that he laid down his life for us." And we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. And you can read that passage and you can think to yourself, "Yeah, I'd do that." Because no one's holding a gun to my head and really making me make that choice. It's just hypothetical whether I'll ever have to lay down my life for the brethren. I've never known anyone that personally to have to do that. But that's not really what John's talking about. In verse 17 he says, "Whoever has the world's goods and beholds his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him?" Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. We lay down our lives for the brethren when we do little things like share of our material resources for those that are in need. But even that, again, needs to be done with some wisdom, because we realize what Paul also teaches at the end of 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. In verse 10, Paul says, "Even when we were with you, we used to give you this order, if anyone will not work, neither let him eat. For we hear that some among you are leading an undisciplined life and doing no work at all, but acting like busybodies. Now such persons we command and exhort in the Lord Jesus Christ to work in quiet fashion and eat their own bread. But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary of doing good. And if anyone does not obey our instruction in this letter, take note of that man and do not associate with him so that he may be put to shame." And so, yes, we need to be content with what God has given to us. We need to enjoy it. We need to exercise restraint and we need to exercise generosity, and all of that with wisdom, guided by the principle that we submit ourselves to Jesus Christ. And you remember, of course, that principle that we began with in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 22. Flee from these things. Flee from the love of money. Flee from the snare that entraps us with money. And pursue righteousness and godliness and faith and love and perseverance and gentleness. What more could you want than those very things that we were created for? The very things that God says bring true satisfaction in life. The richness of a relationship with other people, but ultimately a relationship with God. If you will, take the songbook and turn to the song that Jesse has selected, number 642, "I Am Resolved." Now, what are we resolved to do? Are we resolved to think on things above? To set our mind where Christ is, to govern every aspect of our life by the principles of Jesus Christ, and ultimately to be truly humans, to be fully what God intended us to be from the very beginning. You know, these youthful lusts can be quite powerful, quite an attraction. The appeal of having all the money you could want, and the security and comfort that we could imagine that would bring us in life, and the freedom from worry of where our next meal is going to come from, or whether the car is going to break down, or if we're going to have a place to live. But I'm reminded of something that C.S. Lewis said one time. He made the observation that our problem really is not that our desires are so strong, but just the opposite, really, that our desires are too weak. He said, "Indeed, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition, when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased." And that is so true. If we really understood what God offers to us, we would realize just how weak our desire is. It'd be like settling for this Nutrageous candy bar, which would be pretty satisfying in the immediate here and now, but it's quickly gone. And an eternal banquet awaits that we can partake of, and we will never hunger and never thirst. And that is what God has created us for. And so if there's some way we can help you tonight, are you resolved to be the kind of person God would have you to be? If there's some way we can help you, let us know while we stand and while we sing the song.